from 90.9 WBUR. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Massachusetts chooses the company that will build the nation's first industrialized-size wind farm off the coast of Martha's Vineyard. Also, as we approach the Memorial Day holiday, we look at Massachusetts beaches, which are still damaged after this year's nor'easters. Governor Baker is asking for federal help.
We also have to have a conversation about how we're going to deal with the fact that a lot of the coastal stuff is probably going to be part of our future, and we need to come up with some plans for that.
And 5 years ago, Massachusetts raised the age of adult criminal responsibility from 17 to 18, but should it be even higher?
Having a 19-year-old in an adult prison, it could be a bit much.
Plus, NFL owners approve a new policy that allows players to stay in the locker room during the national anthem, but requires them to stand if they do come on the field. That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Well, state officials have just announced the company that will build Massachusetts' first industrial-sized offshore wind farm. And the winner is, well, here's WBUR's reporter Bruce Gellerman to tell us. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, Deb.
So who won?
Well, there's a surprise, a big surprise. I'm going to tell you about that in a second. But the big winner was Vineyard Wind. It was one of three teams that were competing for this, this proposal for this project, and they're going to build 800 megawatts of a wind farm off the south coast of Martha's Vineyard. Here's Secretary of the Department of Energy and Environmental Resources. I just spoke to him, Matthew Beaton.
It is the most significant step in the Commonwealth history to advancing our clean energy agenda, and it sets the stage for a great future of offshore wind development in the Commonwealth.
So 800 megawatts is half of what the statute requires Massachusetts to build. Governor Baker set that up about 2 years ago. It put the state on a path to be the leader in offshore wind and clean energy, and this fulfills half of that.
Okay, so how much is that, though, when we talk about powering households? How many households are we talking about, Bruce?
It's hard to measure, but it's about 700,000 to 800,000 households. It's about 5, maybe 6% of the state's total energy electric needs. Okay. So it's a lot.
Yeah. So you mentioned that Vineyard Wind isn't exactly a surprise, but there is a surprise. What is it?
Rhode Island is the surprise.
Mm-hmm.
Where that came from, nobody knew about that one. They are going to get 400 megawatts of one of the teams that was competing. It was Deepwater Wind, which built the Block Island Wind. And here's Lars Peterson. Let me get to him a little later. But this is just an unbelievable turn of affairs. Nobody expected this.
Okay, well, let's talk about Vineyard Wind and Deepwater Wind. But let's start with Vineyard Wind, because that's what we're talking about here in Massachusetts. Tell us a little bit about this company.
Vineyard Wind is a combination of actually two companies. They're partners. One's based in Spain, Iberdrola. It's a big clean energy company. Then there's Copenhagen Infrastructure Partnership, which is based, obviously, in Denmark. They're going to have a very ambitious timeline of putting this thing in the ocean. They're going to say this could be operational by 2021. And they're going to be landing the cables that come off the turbines in Barnstable in Cape Cod. They're going to have a big presence on Martha's Vineyard. And the interesting thing about them is they're going to have batteries all over the Cape, basically, in hospitals and police stations and places where the backup energy is needed. Mm. They're going to charge those batteries and use them when things go bad.
Mm. How close to Martha's Vineyard are we talking, and how much space are we talking?
A lot of space. These guys bought up hundreds of square miles. They leased hundreds of square miles from the federal government for buck an acre. Mm. And it's about 15 miles off the southeast coast, southwest coast of Martha's Vineyard.
So visible to most people.
Oh, tiny on the horizon.
Okay. And let's talk about Deepwater Wind. We talked about Vineyard Wind. So what about Deepwater Wind? What do we know about that company that's doing the Rhode Island project?
Well, that's interesting. So they're the ones that built the 5 turbines off Block Island. You remember that about 16, 17 months ago. They made that operational. That's only 5 towers. This one's going to have 100. So it's like one is a toe in the water. This is going in waiting in waist deep. There's going to be 100 towers. They're big, and the turbines are going to be even bigger.
So it's quite a big project, both of these, but particularly Vineyard Wind. So I'm assuming that a selling point here, Bruce, was likely jobs that would have been created. So how many jobs are we talking about?
Right. Generating wind was just part of the equation here. So they want to have, they expect about 2,000. It's hard to measure because they measure it in something called job hours or something like that, how many people can work for a year for 1 hour. It's a very hard formula, but about, say, 2,000 to put these things in the ocean and a couple of hundred to keep them operating and maintained. But there's a big important part of this. That is, they don't want to just have jobs. They want to start an industry. They want to build something that's going to grow, an infrastructure, a workforce that's going to be trained on these things and be able to eventually, perhaps, be able to make the blades and the turbines. So here's Lars Petterson. He's the CEO of Vineyard Wind, and he's talking about how he wants to begin something very big here based in Massachusetts.
We are firm believers that this will be the kickstart of a market. The early movers, they get the first companies to settle in the supply chain, and then companies serving those companies will settle in. And so I think for Massachusetts, this is a new industry to settle in here, and there's a big opportunity here.
Yeah.
So what's next? What happens next, Bruce?
So they've got the company that decides to build these things, Vineyard Wind, has to talk to the utilities and decide who's going to purchase the power and for how much, right? There's three utilities in Massachusetts, and then they go before the DPU and they decide on the price. We still don't know the total price for the project, and we don't know the price for the energy. The DPU signs off on that, and then they've got to go through the entire environmental impact statements for the state and the feds.
Okay. But right now, as you said, operational by 2021.
2021 for the Vineyard Wind and probably 2023 for the Deepwater Rhode Island project.
Okay. WBUR's Bruce Gellerman. Bruce, thanks so much for being with us.
You bet.
We want to go now from offshore to the coast with another Bruce who's with us in studio. This is the upcoming Memorial Day holiday weekend and the kickoff, the unofficial kickoff, really, of summer. But here in New England, many area beaches apparently won't be summer ready for several weeks. Officials say the consecutive winter nor'easters with historic winds and damaging surges, destroyed homes and dunes, and the state is still waiting on federal aid. Marconi Beach in Wellfleet is an example. It won't be open to the public for at least another month, according to Brian Carlstrom, who's superintendent of the Cape Cod National Seashore.
The Marconi stairs were damaged beyond repair, so they're currently in the process of being rebuilt and available for public use by the 4th of July. Hopefully we'll get that done a little bit sooner. And the parking lot up at the Herring Cove Beach sustained a lot of damage from the nor'easters this past spring. So it looks vastly different from what people might remember from last year.
And joining us to take a look at the state of the state's beaches is Bruce Berman, the other Bruce, with the environmental group Save the Harbor, Save the Bay. Welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
So can you give a general statement? How are our beaches right now coming off this winter?
I can say that it was a brutal winter. With wicked bad storms coming on wicked high tides. And as a result, there was extensive damage to coastal infrastructure, like seawalls and stairways, and also to the beaches themselves. The good news here in the Boston area is that the beaches are open. And the bad news is, I think, that it's likely that we're going to be facing this kind of a challenge much more frequently than we have in the past, as the clear consensus is that the ocean's getting deeper, it's getting warmer, and it's getting more stormy.
Well, let's talk about the areas where we're seeing some problems. Quincy, right? Gloucester, Nahant. Tell us what's happening there.
The good news is that many of these beaches, certainly the metropolitan beaches, will be open. The bad news is I think that there's not a beach in the Commonwealth that if you love it and go to it, you won't see that it's different than it was last year. Mm-hmm. Those folks that live on the Cape near Chatham are used to watching the cut move up and down. Some years there's a big beach, some years there's not. It's becoming increasingly like that here. So, on the ocean-facing beaches like Quincy, Nahant, and Nantasket, there was damage and erosion that's fairly dramatic. They're still open, but there's going to be boulders and other debris that haven't been moved yet.
Yeah. Now, the governor's requesting federal aid, as we said, right? I think the preliminary damage assessment that just one of the big storms that we had this winter caused about $24 million worth of damage. The governor's also filed legislation, right, for $300 million in aid for coastal communities to kind of prepare. So there's a lot of money, but I think some people might be looking at this and saying, you know what, Bruce, we spend a lot of money on repairing these dunes in Nahant every year, like, and the sand gets washed out to sea. Are there other ways we could sort of protect the beaches, or are we letting all the money go into the ocean?
Okay, so I'm gonna tear that question into a couple pieces.
Okay, I figured you would.
The first thing is that we can't stop the rising sea, and we know that. Mm. What we have to remember, and this is the message that I think came out of EEA and Matt Beaton's team, is that not only are these beaches recreational assets, but what they are the first line of coastal defense for our communities. So while you're going to face questions about whether or not you put sand back on a beach if you know it's going to roll away, you have to ask yourself whether or not you want to harden a causeway and make sure that there's appropriate protection to keep coastal roads from actually washing away and cutting off communities. I think that this is not a short-term problem. I mean, certainly getting debris off the beach, fixing the stairway at Marconi on the Cape, or that's a short-term issue. What's critical and what I'm really proud about, if there's good news in this story, is that we live in Massachusetts, where the legislature, the governor, the Metropolitan Beaches Commission, Mayor Walsh, and all our leaders are on the same page. Mm-hmm. We know what the problem is, and we know that the first step is to get every town in Massachusetts to take a look at what their risks are, to do a risk assessment. Some have. The governor's included funds in the bond bill to help others do it. And at the same time, the Commonwealth has to take a look at their assets. Obviously, assets like utilities and water plants, but also at parks and beaches. That's the first step. Mm-hmm. And then we have to figure out what we're going to prioritize, where we're going to retreat, if that's what happens. And where we're going to look for new ways to be more resilient.
Retreat means what, dude?
Retreat means if you've got six houses that are at the edge of a community that are constantly getting cut off, it's unlikely that society's going to be paying to fix your road. But when you look at a place where the beach that you're restoring protects an entire community from being overwashed and destroyed, then you have a different situation.
Is this really the result of these bad winter storms?
So there's been a history, 30-year history, right, of underinvesting in infrastructure and parks and on the beaches. And so there, you'd find disrepair here and disrepair there at nearly any park, as the DCR staff, who's pretty game, worked real hard to, address the issues. This accelerated it dramatically. And there's no question that if you go to your favorite beach, you will see what happened as a result of this year's storms. And, their frequency and their strength is clearly increasing as there's more energy and warmer water in the sea.
Now, I know you mentioned this, but I want to play a piece of tape from Governor Baker from back in March when he was touring storm damage in Quincy. And he said that this series of storms, the bad nor'easters that we had this season, raise really a lot of big questions. Let's listen to what he said.
What can be done by the folks at the state level? What can be done at the city? But then we also have to have a conversation about how we're going to deal with the fact that a lot of the coastal stuff is probably going to be part of our future, and we need to come up with some plans for that.
Right. So what do we do, though? I mean, it's very difficult to plan for the sort of unknown, and we're guessing about what might happen if, right? So how's the best way to gauge preparedness and plan for this, Bruce?
Well, I'll tell you what. We're getting better at it. Let me give you an example. When you build a new building in Boston, you need to make allowances that will enable you to be back in business more quickly. That means that the ground floor, for example, you don't put your utilities there, that they go on the roof. Mm-hmm. It means that you build the land to a higher level. Deer Island, I think, is one of the best examples of this. They're very forward-thinking, and they actually elevated that island sufficiently to provide much more protection than you'd find at any other sewage treatment plant in the country. That said, this isn't an inexpensive proposition, and we have to look for ways to creatively fund it. We also have to design our parks and our beaches in ways that they're more resilient to being overtopped by a rising tide.
Do we need to rethink coastal housing?
You know, it depends. It's on a case-by-case basis. Hmm. Again, there are places where it's obvious that in the long term that if you want to go to your house, you're going to have a boat.
Mm-hmm.
The question about whether or not we want the town of Nahant to become an island is a bigger question. And it's not the only place where we have to look at the long-term strategy here. It's difficult to, you know, in some places, without calling Florida out by name, in some places, you know, you're not allowed to have discussions about, in a planning process that assume that there is such a thing as climate change or sea level rise. Here in Massachusetts, Governor Baker, as I said, and Mayor Walsh and the legislature, they're on the same page. It's a question of, assess the risks and work on that plan.
Okay, so it's beach season. I'm saying it is, even if
it is today.
It is. Well, it is allegedly. So we'll see. We're in New England. But what do you tell beachgoers? What's your advice for beachgoers this year overall? And I know you're going to release an annual report this weekend. You can't say what it is yet, but how are beaches?
You know, in the broadest sense, I have to say water quality has really improved up and down the coast. And because of almost the passion and the commitment of the line staff at the parks agencies, they're going to be in the best shape that they can be with the resources we had after the winter we had. What I'd say to people is have a really great time at the beach. Remember that the water's a little bit cold, even though there's warmer water overall. But I'd also suggest that they get involved, that they join their local beach friends group, take part in a cleanup, mm-hmm. volunteer for Park Serve Day, make a contribution to Save the Harbor, Save the Bay's annual appeal, to do what they can to actually not only enjoy their beach mm-hmm. and share their beach, but to take care of their beach. Now, that said, I also think that's important for everybody that works in the space that I work in to thank the people in government that make decisions that protect these important resources.
Right. Bruce Berman, Director of Strategy and Communication for Save the Harbor, Save the Bay, which is an environmental advocacy group. Thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
Stay with us. Coming up, a look at juvenile justice in Massachusetts and what the state might learn from Germany's approach. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. As states such as Massachusetts consider whether to raise the age of adult criminal responsibility beyond 18, in Germany, they're debating whether to raise it to 24, meaning that anyone younger than that would be dealt with in the juvenile, not the adult justice system. How Germany handles young people charged with crimes is something that a group from Massachusetts recently witnessed firsthand. A delegation of state lawmakers, law enforcement officials, attorneys and juvenile justice reform activists traveled together to Germany. They watched trials of young people accused of crimes. They toured detention facilities and they talked with the officials and the young people involved in the system there. Many of those who went on the trip say Massachusetts might be able to take some lessons from Germany about this, and they're here in the studio to talk with us. Suffolk County Sheriff Stephen Tompkins is one of them. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Also, Commissioner of the Massachusetts Department of Youth Services, Peter Forbes, is with us as well. Thanks for coming in.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
We want to also invite our listeners into this conversation. Should young adults be treated differently in the criminal justice system? Should Massachusetts raise the age of adult criminal responsibility? You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet to Radio Boston. So first, I want to start with you. Sheriff, we should talk to you a little bit about the trip, and I want to say the Columbia Justice Lab sponsored this trip. But tell us, what are some of your impressions from going over there and what you learned about Germany's juvenile justice system?
Well, let me preface that by saying this. I was really encouraged and inspired by the group of people that they put together. It was a collection of law enforcement officials, judges, prosecutors, legislators, social service individuals. And the reason I start with that is because we all had an opportunity to talk about what we'd witness, what we'd learn from our respective areas of influence. And so we learned a lot from each other there. Fast forward, one of the things that really stuck out to me is this. In my academy, when I bring officers on, we give them a 12-week academy. Their officers go through a 2-year academy. And I think that's really significant because it really gives the officers an opportunity to understand the social aspect of folk that are incarcerated. And so they're really more like social workers or caseworkers than officers. And I thought that was extraordinary, particularly when you're dealing with young minds.
Right. What does that do to the culture of the whole system when that's the approach, do you think?
I think it's more compassionate, frankly. Mm-hmm. You know, where I believe that our system may be a little more strident, maybe a little more punitive. This is a little more compassionate because, first and foremost, to me at least, they always remember that they're dealing with human beings and that these human beings will eventually go home. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's very important. So I think their culture is a lot different than ours.
Mm. But most of the people that we incarcerate go home too. What about in your facility?
Well, in my facility, because I'm a county sheriff. Right. And so on average, guys are there 12 to 14 months, ladies 6 to 9 months. Mm-hmm. If you look at the state system, it's a lot different. You have more lifers. You have longer sentences, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. Peter, correct me, but I believe in one of the individuals that we spoke to said that the average sentence for murder is 10 years.
In Germany, the average sentence is 10 years.
Years. And so when you talk about the fact that they're going home, they are going to get that second chance.
So this is a rehabilitative approach as opposed to a more punitive
approach.
That's
a great way to say it.
Would you agree with that, Peter?
Yeah. I mean, I think the focus, the framework, really, the paradigm was rehabilitation and lower recidivism. What do we need to do from a rehabilitation standpoint to lower the likelihood that this individual is going to commit another crime? And everybody was very clear that there was no retribution in the equation on the youth side, mm-hmm. that it was really rehabilitation, lower recidivism, and not retribution. And we heard that channeled by everybody that we talked to across the system. So to me, that really was something that stood out in the process.
Mm. That was the big thing to you?
That was one thing.
Yeah. What was another?
Well, I think, from a practical standpoint, as a person that's a practitioner, the fact that they had really well-developed vocational programming, vocational shops, they had a system where young people that are in there, what they call youth prisons, would get either credit or credentialed in a way that they could take that credential into the community and earn a living wage in an industry. So it was really very thoughtful and very well developed, and focused. The focus on the programming side was far more oriented toward work and placement than it was on traditional academics and education, and that stood out to me.
Right. So I guess I think a lot of folks probably might agree that we could do probably a more compassionate approach here for young people. I think a lot of people would agree with that, and they would probably say, but does that protect public safety well enough? And what does it cost? And how do we know that people who are treated in a more rehabilitative setting aren't recidivating at a higher rate? So did we learn about any of that on that trip? Sheriff, you first.
Yes.
So public safety, recidivism, what do we know about that?
Yeah, I mean, and so far as public safety is concerned, they are very aware of the public's need to feel safe and secure, while at the same time, I go back to the fact that people really need to have a second chance at heightening their station in life. Mm-hmm. And from the folk that we spoke to, not just the practitioners, but the common people that we had in the citizens of Germany that we had a chance to talk to, they didn't seem like they felt that they weren't secure. You know, I mean, there's going to be crime everywhere. Here's an interesting thing, though. So they don't have the same kind of gunplay that we have in this mm-hmm. country. And so when you talk about security there versus talking about security here, the conversation is totally different. Because of the proliferation of guns. Now, first and foremost, let me say this. I am not in any way, shape, or form saying that guns should be done away with. I am not talking about the Second Amendment. That being the case, though, we do have a lot of gunplay here that they don't. Mm-hmm. And so when you talk about feeling safe, it's a lot different. Mm-hmm. At least that was my perception.
And how about cost? Is it more expensive?
You know, truthfully, I don't remember. Do you know that number?
I'm not sure. We didn't really get a cost center,
yeah. uh-huh.
but clearly the way they were staffing their youth facilities, they were staffing it at a higher level than what you would see in a correctional facility in Massachusetts. They had more staff, more clinical staff, more vocational programming. So I would guess it's more expensive. I think for the exciting thing for Massachusetts, I think, is really to figure out what's the most effective way. We're spending a lot of public money, so how can we spend the public money in a way that gets us the best possible outcome? And Germany is, you know, it's. I think it was instructive to look at what they were doing.
Mm-hmm. So let me say this to you, though, Deb. So in my facility, it costs about $55,000 annually to incarcerate. Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am. To incarcerate one individual, I have over 1,600 on any given day. And you'll hear some of our legislators and our governor talk about the fact that the count, the body count, is going down. What the word that they leave out, though, is they leave out the convicted body count is going down, juxtaposed to the pretrial body count, which is not going down, and in some cases is going up. And so it's nice to say that the numbers are going down, but let's look at who's in jail. First of all, you have a lot of pretrial folk, but then you also have a lot of people that are suffering from either substance abuse or mental health issues. And so the cost to take care of those individuals has skyrocketed. And so I understand the discussion about the need to take from Peter to pay Paul, but I don't see how that happens. We need to identify new revenue streams, frankly, to take care of folk before they fall into the criminal justice system. Yeah. It was my contention that a lot of people that are with me shouldn't be. They should have gone into a diversionary program, or they should be in a mental health or substance abuse bed outside of a correction facility.
Peter Forbes, you know, when we talk about increasing the number of people who potentially would go into the juvenile system, do we have the capacity to deal with that? If I know the initial proposal before Massachusetts about raising the age of adult criminal responsibility was up to 19. That didn't make it in the criminal justice reform bill. There are some folks who say that they may increase it to 21. Does our system have the capacity to handle the folks who are now incarcerated between the ages of 18 and 21? Would the juvenile system be able to take them in?
No, I mean, I think there would be a cost factor and a programming factor, because that would be a shift from the adult system to the juvenile justice system, and that's a policy issue that is undecided, is out there. But if you were to infuse thousands of 18 to 21-year-olds into the Department of Youth Services, clearly there would be a cost, because it costs more to have a young person in a secure bed in a youth service facility in Massachusetts than it does to have them on the adult side. The cost, you know, related to education, clinical, and the way we staff our programs, it's just a more expensive model.
What's the average cost right now, and how many young people in the system, do you know?
How many young people average daily right now, mm-hmm. that are in custody? About 800, I believe, is the number. And the cost for a long-term secure treatment bed for 365 days is in the range of about $125,000.
Mm-hmm. Is that an average cost for an average youth locked up? Or when you say secure treatment, is that any kind of specialty treatment, or $125 is sort of the average cost for a young person who would be in a detention facility?
That's one type of program that we run, and that's a cost that I don't have the math in front of me, but that's kind of a ballpark cost on average for somebody that's in a long-term program.
So that's more than double the cost. So that would be more expensive. It would definitely be more expensive. What would we get back? Any ideas in terms of the recidivism rate if Massachusetts were to adopt something more like a German model? Do we know what the recidivism rate is in Germany? You know, people will be saying, is it worth my investment?
Right.
What is it?
I don't have all that in front of me. They promoted that they incarcerate fewer people and that they have a lower recidivism rate than what we have here in Massachusetts, I believe by about half, but I'm not sure of the exact math.
And our recidivism rate is about 46%, you know. And so, but what I would say to answer that question is that if you take that young mind, we all understand that the brain doesn't fully mature until you're 25 or 26. If you can get to that youngster and to work with them, you have a better chance of interrupting that cycle of criminality, which would then interrupt that cycle of recidivism. And so I think it's a good, healthy approach. Now, some of my fellow sheriffs may not agree with me on that, but I do believe that we should incrementally raise the age. It shouldn't be in one fell swoop, given what Peter said, to have all these people show up overnight wouldn't be good. But every 2 years, every 3 years, 5 years, you up it 1 year, I think it's a good thing.
Hmm. Peter, do you think it's a good idea to raise the age?
I'm really not in a position to take a hard stand on that, so I'm going to defer that question.
Okay. Well, listeners, you can weigh in if you'd like. We want to hear from you. Should Massachusetts raise the age of adult criminal responsibility beyond 18? You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. I do want to bring in another perspective from someone who does not agree with you, Sheriff, as you mentioned, that not everyone does, but this is not another sheriff. This is Lincoln Police Chief Kevin Kennedy. Chief Kennedy, thanks for taking the time to talk with us.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
So why not raise the age?
We look at the current, proposal, raising it to 21, I think as a law enforcement community, we're currently opposed. I think there's an awful lot of unanswered questions to that. But that being said, I think the police community stands, united in collaborating with the criminal justice system and our community partners in finding innovative ways to decrease recidivism rates among our young people. I think when you look at the criminal justice reform bill that was recently passed, I think as Sheriff Thompson recently mentioned about, earlier intervention, and I think it's really important to understand that for the first time, diversion and restorative justice practices will be available across the Commonwealth. And just as in speaking as it relates to Middlesex County, diversion and restorative justice programs have been in place for a number of years, and in my opinion, have been very successful in helping young adults correct the root cause of their behavior. And when you look at just raising the age to 21, there is really no direct correlation that raising the age alone is going to reduce recidivism. It really comes down to individualized programs and treatment that's going to correct the offender's root cause while putting systems in place to support that young adult or juvenile. And when you look at the whole adolescent brain development, I think the system, you have to break the system, when I say the criminal justice system, into three specific groups, that being the juveniles, obviously, who are under 18, and the young adults that are between the ages of 18 and 24, and then over 24. And when you look at just raising the age to 21, you're still not addressing the concerns of the 21 to 24 population. And what the Criminal Justice Reform Bill has done, it allows the Department of Corrections and the sheriffs to open up these young adult correctional units. And that is just what has taken place in Middlesex County with Sheriff Katusian, who has recently opened in the past 3 months. And again, that addresses that it's the young adult population, 18 to 24, which was created in partnership with the Vera Institute.
Right.
Institute actually looked at Germany's the Germany prison system as a model to create this unit.
Okay, but I'm just wondering, the folks who say that we should increase the age, they say, as you heard probably just in this program, that sometimes putting younger people, even those, 19, 20, 21, 22-year-olds in with older people who've been accused of crimes can have a detriment, and I'm paraphrasing what you've told me, particularly you, Sheriff, so if you want to chime in here and correct me, feel free. But, I mean, that could actually have a long-term detrimental effect on that young person and inhibit that person's ability to really change their life and turn it around when they're at an age where they might be able to do so. So why not raise the age here? Are you just saying that the unilateral approach to doing it is what's the problem?
I think it should be, the system should be in place where you're creating these young adult units, and I agree they should be separated from the older inmates and things of that nature. I completely agree. But I think you have to, I think it, they're more similarly aligned between 18 and 24, are better off to be placed together and treated similarly and provide that individualized services and treatment and so forth, rather than putting them all in, 21-year-olds with 14-year-olds. Mm. I think that's an issue that I'm sure Commissioner Forbes could address.
Mm-hmm. But also you're also telling those young adults that they have been involved in the criminal justice system. It's not diversion, and it does have long-lasting effects for those people to have something on their criminal record.
Oh, no, I agree. And I think, you know, for the first time, we're very much in favor of diversion restorative justice programs. And I think, you know, until the passage of this bill, these programs have not been available, you know, to all the youth and young adults in the system.
So Sheriff,
this is the first time that it's going to be available.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to agree with the chief on two points. One, I totally agree that we should have some diversionary programs prior to kids falling into the criminal mm-hmm. justice system. I think that's the best way to go. Two, like Sheriff Katusian, we are about to open up an 18 to 25-year-old unit ourselves, and we're going to model it after a program that we went down to visit in Connecticut called the TRUE program in Cheshire, Connecticut, where they have about 45 youngsters or young men in a cell, in a unit rather, with about 8 to 10 lifers. Guys that will never get out. And they really engage in the restorative justice approach, the healing circles. And in that unit, they have rival gangs, which is kind of something that we really don't want to do here. They have rival gangs there. There are no fights. There are no disruptions. Mm. And the recidivism rate for the gentleman leaving that unit is minuscule. And so when you look at an innovative approach to this, I think it's a healthy thing. Also, I just want to reference the criminal justice bill, which for the most part, I agree with the chief. I think it's a pretty darn good bill. What it does not do, though, is they do not come forth with enough money for aftercare. So what happens to these individuals once they leave? If you don't have enough money on the street for the social service agencies to then put their arms around them, chances are that they may recidivate. And so as they tweak this bill, which is what I hope they do as it goes forward, they put more money into it. I think they put our, in the Commonwealth, we put $3 million in. There are some states that have put over $75, $80, $90 million into the aftercare component.
Okay, so the reentry and the aftercare
Absolutely.
Is just as important. We can't do
Absolutely.
That. I want you to just stand by for a second, and I want to say goodbye to Lincoln Chief Kevin Kennedy. Chief, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And I want to go to one of our listeners now who wants to weigh in on this, and I'm reminding all listeners, if you do have a comment about this, about raising the age of adult criminal responsibility in Massachusetts beyond 18, our number is 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Larry is calling from Auburndale. Larry, you're on the air.
Deborah, you'll recognize my voice.
I do.
My question to your guests is that, and you alluded to it in the early remarks of your two guests, that the cost here may be quite significant by comparing Germany to Suffolk or Middlesex County. I wondered, my question to your guests is, the legislators that accompanied you, did they comprehend as well as you do, what you were observing. In my district, I'm represented by two lightweights that would not understand the conversation that you were having with Ms. Becker.
Okay. So lawmakers, do lawmakers understand all of the policy ramifications of what's going on here in terms of criminal justice? Is that the main question?
That's the
question. Yeah. Okay. So, Sheriff, what would you say to Larry?
Larry, I would absolutely say that they did. We had Representative Kahn, we had Dan Hunt, we had Representative Fiola, and a number of these folks actually sit on the public safety and the judiciary committees, mm-hmm. and so they understand. But interesting, that question is interesting insofar as this is concerned. When I first was appointed sheriff back in 2013, it was around budget season, and I went into the State House to talk about our budget. And the representatives sitting across from me just had that deer in the headlights look in their eyes. They had no idea what I was talking about. And I asked them, I said, how many of you have actually visited my facility? At that time, not one. Not one had ever been in. So they have jurisdiction over my dollars, but they don't know what my dollars are doing. And then we invited them in. And once they came in and had an opportunity to talk to our practitioners, to talk to some of the inmates, the next year, the budgetary difference, it was a little bit better. It wasn't as much as we'd like, but it was a little bit better because they had a better understanding. So I would say that the legislators on this trip got it. Would you agree with me?
Yeah, I mean, there was a range of experience with the legislative group that came, but they were very impressive mm-hmm. as far as their grasp and their interest. And I think the purpose of the trip was for all of us to learn a little more about the business. So the fact that they took the time to go for a week and spend that amount of time, like on the bus, in the facilities. I mean, it was a long trip, and I was very impressed by the legislative group.
And I'll go back to my first comment: the fact that we did have prosecutors and defense attorneys and sheriffs and police chiefs. Brian Kies was on the trip. Yep. That gave us an opportunity to talk to legislators about what they just seen or what they just heard, and they had a chance to talk to us about what they just seen and heard. Right. So it worked out pretty well.
Yeah, it sounds like that would have been a real, you know, one of the big takeaways from that, really, was being able to spend that much time together sharing ideas.
Yeah.
Right?
We did. We actually did a bus ride from northern Germany back into Berlin for about three and a half hours and used that to debrief. And everybody on the bus spoke, and it was a very it was very novel. It was an interactive approach, and it was the most productive bus trip I ever was on. Huh. But it was all about learning.
It's kind of sad that you had to go to Germany for that, but that's okay.
Yeah,
it's not
a little expensive. Yeah.
A little expensive, but that's
but
okay.
Deb, can I make a point about this trip also? Mm. So another takeaway. So in their systems, in their jails, they do not have windows on the doors of the cells. So you can, an officer cannot look inside. They don't have cameras in the halls like we do, okay? And it goes back to, interestingly enough, the Holocaust. And what was explained to us is, after the Holocaust, there was a privacy clause that was introduced and incorporated into their constitution that said that you, every citizen has to be afforded a certain level of privacy. That is something that we would never, I can't ever see that happening in the States, where we would not have a way to look into the cell to see if that individual is okay or if something is going wrong. I found that extraordinary.
Yeah.
But it works for them. Mm. I don't think it would work here.
No, why?
Because that our culture is different. Our system is not built on that. Our system is built on knowing exactly what's going on within those cells. My mandate is care, custody, and control. If I can't see what's going on, I'm losing that. And that is just not something that I would be open to.
Commissioner Forbes, your office is part of this task force looking at the raising of the juvenile age. What's I know you don't want to make a commitment about how, where you stand on it, but what are some of the things you're looking at to even make that determination?
Clearly, when you get to, right now, we actually have a group of young people that are 18, 19, and 20 under the Youthful Offender Act that passed in 1996. So we have about 140 young people that are kind of in that age group. And I think that, you know, our concern from a planning standpoint would be, what's the investment in VOC and employment training and job placement in the community? Because when you get from 17 to 18 to 19, things start to shift. Priorities shift from education to employment. And I think that the older group requires more resources and more strategic planning around things that they need. 18, 19, and 20-year-olds, they need their driver's license. They need a safe place to live. A lot of them are becoming parents. So the whole social agenda starts to change as you're working with that older group. And so as our participation in that task force will really be about, I think, informing people about what the programmatic considerations are for success. Because that's really what I think Massachusetts wants to land in, a place where we wind up having better outcomes.
Right. We should say Connecticut's doing this as well. And you mentioned the facility in Connecticut, Sheriff. I'm wondering, you know, is there a collaboration at all? I know Connecticut's looking at raising the age to 21, too. So I'm assuming that everybody's looking at sort of the same issues here. Is that something that you're looking at jointly? And is this sort of a trend of changing the way we deal with young people charged with crimes? You're shaking your head, Sheriff.
Yeah, I believe it is a trend, not just in the way we deal with young people, but the way we deal with people that we're going to send away to pay a debt to society. And so because of the cost, number one, and because in this country we incarcerate far too many of our citizens, a lot of which are black and brown, we can't do that any longer. I just don't think we can. We can't afford it. And I think we're destroying not only that individual, I'm not going to say we are, but that individual's life, their family, and their community is going to be impacted negatively because they're away. But if I might, Deb, I'd like to just make one other point about what Peter just mentioned. On average, my population has a fifth or sixth grade math and literacy proficiency level. Mm. So these aren't individuals that are going to necessarily go on to college. So in 2005, my predecessor allowed me to look at our academic schematic and put a heavy emphasis on vocational education. So we teach them landscaping, custodial maintenance, painting, printing, so on and so forth. And then we talk to employers about the fact that, yes, these individuals have been away, But they didn't just sit on their thumbs. They actually learned a skill. And we've been pretty fortunate to get a good percentage of those folks hired. Here's the problem. A lot of them have never been on a professional job site. And so if they make it to that 6 month, they generally keep the job. Mm. But a lot of them hadn't. And so what we found is we had to actually create a program called attitude adjustment. So we not only had to teach them the skill, but then we had to teach them how to comport themselves professionally so that if they did get a job, that they were on time, that their slacks were pulled up. If they had a supervisor, I'm serious here. If they had a supervisor that may have spoken to them in a way that they didn't like, you just can't just go off and show anger because you could lose that job, you see. So I think that we are, as a country, looking at ways to incarcerate fewer people.
Right. You sure you're a sheriff? You don't sound like a sheriff.
I hear that a lot.
Yeah, okay. This is Suffolk County Sheriff Steve Tompkins. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Also, Peter Forbes, Commissioner of the State Department of Youth Services. Commissioner, thanks for joining us in studio.
Thanks for having us.
Coming up, we'll be talking sports with Only a Games Bill Littlefield. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. We want to check in on the world of sports now, particularly with some news today. The NFL has approved a new policy that it says is designed to end the controversy over protesting the national anthem. We also, of course, have the big Celtics series. And with me in the studio to talk about these things and more is Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Hi there, Bill.
Hello, Deb.
So let's go to the Celtics first. They take on Cleveland tonight, game 5 of the Eastern Conference Finals. Series tied right now, 2-2. Celtics head coach Brad Stevens says he's only looking forward. Let's listen.
It's the best 2 out of 3 to go to the NBA Finals. Doesn't get better than that. I mean, ultimately, you know, anybody that didn't think this was going to be tough, I mean, everything is tough. And, you know, in this deal, it's a blast to have to grit your teeth, get up off the mat, and go after it again.
A blast. So Bill, the Celtics started out strong. People thought it was, it was really just going to be sort of wiping the floor with the Cavs here. How might tonight's home court advantage help out?
That's the great mystery. I don't know why they can only win at home. I don't know if it's the chemistry provided by the crowd or if it's the baskets are a quarter of an inch shorter or closer to the floor. I really have no idea.
Don't start but with another gate or something.
Something mysterious is going on. They played okay on the road during the regular season. So I don't know. Maybe it's the fact that they're playing, obviously, teams that are very charged up in the postseason. But whatever it is, we have to hope that the home court advantage holds, two more times.
Right. What do you think about the team overall, about how it's been doing?
I can't figure it out. I really can't. On some days, they look as if they know exactly what they're doing, and they anticipate each other's movements with just incredible precision. The passes are good. The opportunities are there. And then you look at the first quarter of game 4, it looked like they went out and collected a bunch of guys who had never met each other, and they didn't have any idea what to do. And as a result, LeBron James and the Cavaliers made him look like amateurs.
I actually think I heard the commentator say during that game, this is really sloppy basketball.
It was, and the irony, of course, was that for the next 2 quarters, they outplayed the Cavs and outscored the Cavs. If they hadn't dug themselves such a deep hole in the first quarter, we might be looking at 3-1 right now.
Right. So let's talk about, let's move on and talk about the news in the NFL today. The league announced that new policy saying players can stay in the locker room during the national anthem. But if they do go on the field and kneel during the anthem, the team will be fined. So what's your immediate reaction, Ruben?
Ever since I read this story, I've been trying to think of a policy that would be stupider, and I can't. This is the surest way to create a divide between players and between the players and the owners that I could possibly imagine. You're saying, well, yeah, you can stay in the locker room and you can come out on, if you're willing to stand for the anthem, you can come out on the field. What can possibly, this only a room full of old white men presiding over a workplace made up predominantly of young black men, how could they possibly do this? Right. And the only reason is they're trying to appease somebody who thinks that anybody who doesn't stand for the anthem ought to be fired. And he's in the White House right now. And so and lots of the owners, as you know, make contributions to his campaign. So this is, I suppose, on the current landscape, it's no dumber than lots of other things that are going on. But boy, it stands out in sports.
And challenges are likely, so we'll see.
I hope so. Yeah, if they just roll over on this, then yeah, boy, I sure hope there are challenges aplenty from the ACLU and elsewhere.
Right,
players.
On a lighter note, where is Tom Brady? Right, he's been absent. Well, we have to ask. Bill.
See, I know, and the NFL—they're so brilliant at marketing. They really hope that all the fans are going to be so concerned about why Tom Brady isn't in camp for a mini camp that they'll kind of not notice this stupid policy that they've just instituted. Look, shiny things over here, Tom Brady.
All right, Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, which airs right here on WBUR Saturdays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. Thanks, Bill.
My pleasure. Thanks, Deb.
That's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.